Hello, and welcome to episode 144 of the new Ice City podcast. I'm your host, Vincent Mercogliano of the USA Today Network, and I'm going to start right off the top by giving you guys fair warning. This week's episode is going to have a little bit of a different feel. I will explain why. There are just going to be two segments, and I think for some good reasons that I'll lay out here. Number one being that we have a really exciting guest lined up for you this week. We are going to be joined in just a little while by Neil Smith. Maybe some younger Rangers fans might not be super familiar with that name, although you certainly should be. I know the older fans are definitely familiar with that name. Neil Smith was the general manager of the Rangers from 1989 through 2000. Of course, that means he was the GM at the time that the Rangers won their last Stanley Cup in 1994. We are now approaching the 30-year anniversary of that last championship for the franchise, which is why I thought it would be a great time to reach out to Neil, have him on the show, pick his brain. Number one, hopefully we can reflect and hear some pretty good stories about what that team went through and what that whole experience was like and the stuff that went on behind the scenes, the trades, the players, the coaches, all the crazy stuff. And if you've read about that team, there was a lot of stuff going on at that time. And then I also wanted to pick his brain a little bit about this year's team and what he sees from them and whether or not he believes that they have what it takes to maybe end that drought this coming spring. So we're going to talk to Neil about all things Rangers and touch on the 30-year anniversary in just a little while. But the other reason that we're just doing two segments this week and things are a little hectic right now is that it really has been unexpectedly a crazy 24 hours for definitely the Rangers and also me, if I'm being honest with you. I spent Wednesday doing the bulk of the writing for a feature that I wrote on Alexi Lafreniere. If you guys haven't had a chance to check this one out yet, I would definitely like to encourage you to do so, whether it's at LoHUD.com/sports/Rangers or any of our other USA Today properties. This was one that I definitely enjoyed writing, that I put some decent legwork and time into, both spending time in the locker room, talking to some of Lafreniere's teammates, a lot of the veteran guys that have been here since he first arrived, as well as reaching out to some people that know Lafreniere away from the Rangers and just trying to dig into exactly what we're seeing. Because I know I've mentioned this on the podcast multiple times in recent weeks, but to me, the way that he is ascending right now has been one of the most encouraging things, I believe, for this team and one of the most important things for this team as far as I think what they're going to need in the playoffs. He's now up to 54 points this season with six games to play, so he's got a chance at hitting 60. 54 is already easily a career high for him. 26 goals, got another couple points in the win over the New Jersey Devils on Wednesday night. 16 points in 14 games in the month of March. So we just continue to see improvement from him. He just looks so confident and decisive and assertive and sure of himself to me on the ice right now, and especially offensively. The way that he's both getting himself into good shooting positions and scoring at a pretty high rate, I think it's 8 goals in his last 9 games right now, but also the way that he's using that playmaking ability and that skill and that vision that made him the number one overall pick in the draft a few years ago, and now we're starting to see it pop. So I actually, probably the most interesting person I spoke to for that story was his strength and conditioning coach that he's been working with for like 11 years now. And I got some really interesting nuggets on what they did this summer specifically to improve his skating and how it was really related to what they talked about was increasing his hip mobility and the importance of that and how that's helped him create more separation on the ice to let that skill shine. So really fascinating story, I thought. Definitely, I think, one of the deeper dives I've done this season. And so I spent a lot of time on Wednesday tying that one up. And again, please, if you get a chance, I think you'd really enjoy reading it. And I would certainly appreciate it if you do. So my Wednesday was devoted to that. I left pretty much right at the buzzer to drive into the city and get to Madison Square Garden for the Rangers against the Devils on Wednesday night, which, if I'm being honest, felt like when I'm walking in a fairly inconsequential game. Now, we knew there could be some fireworks. We knew that there was a high likelihood that Matt Rempe would answer the bell and finally fight Curtis McDermott, who had called him out after their previous meeting because Rempe wasn't taking the bait when they played back, I think I was on March 11th. And then ultimately, Rempe ends up hitting Jonas Siegenthaler with that elbow in the head that resulted in the four-game suspension. And then we heard the comments from McDermott after the game where he called him out, said he was losing respect for him, and thought that he didn't live up to the NHL quote-unquote code by refusing to fight him in that game. So you knew that Rempe was going to want to step up and sort of defend himself and prove that obviously he was man enough to answer the bell there. And after being a healthy scratch in the previous three games, obviously Peter Laviolette, although he's been playing it coy with this and saying that that specifically wasn't the reason that he put Rempe back in the lineup in that game, we all probably know the truth. Laviolette said that it was just because they wanted to add size and physicality and toughness into the lineup. But deep down, you know that even though Laviolette has said he wants to see Rempe not feel obligated to fight at the drop of the puck right to begin a game, not to feel obligated to put on these staged fights, that when a guy is called out publicly like that, obviously I think the Rangers and Laviolette wanted to give him a chance to stand up for himself and defend his name. So Rempe slots in, McDermott is in the Devils lineup, and then we see the starting lineups come out, and we say, oh, well, looks like they're going to get this thing over right off the bat because they were both going to be on the ice for the initial puck drop. But then beyond that, you figured, okay, they're going to get over with that, and that'll be, you know, something that the fans are buzzing about early in the game. But the Rangers have their playoff spot clinched. We're pretty much at the point in the season now where we're counting down the days until we get there. So it didn't seem like it was going to be this massive story. It would obviously be some kind of a story, but it didn't seem like it would be a massive thing. But then I just, of course, am focused on Rempe and McDermott. And you could tell that they're both gearing up for, as soon as that puck is dropped, they're going to drop the gloves. What I didn't really notice until, I don't know, it felt like a long time. It was probably like 5 or 10 seconds. But what I didn't really notice, because I was so focused on wanting to watch this Rempe-McDermott fight, is that the other 8 skaters on the ice were all engaged in fights at the same time. So you had one of those classic throwback line brawls that we did see. A couple of the players reminded me of this after the game. I almost forgot. It wasn't that long ago, but we did see that 4 years ago with the Rangers and the Washington Capitals in a response after Tom Wilson ragdolled Artemi Panarin. But this felt like it was just, I don't know, it felt like it was more blindsided, kind of a crazier circumstance. And then you have all these fights going on at the same time. Rempe and McDermott, heavyweight fight there. That one went much longer than the rest of the fights. And McDermott, I mean, that dude was hitting Rempe with some pretty heavy blows early on in that fight. I talked to Rempe today. I'm definitely going to address more of that on this episode. Rempe said he was the biggest and strongest guy out of all the people that he's fought so far. So shows you there's a certain level of respect there, especially now that they finally got to that fight. But I mean, it was just an absolutely wild scene. You had Keandre Miller, who's never had an NHL fight, put a pretty good whooping on John Marino, which I caught that out of the corner of my eye at a certain point and just noticed that Miller just had him completely down on the ice. And it almost looked like Marino was curled up being like, all right, I've had enough. You also had Jacob Trouba fighting. You had Barclay Gaudreau fighting. You had Jimmy Vesey fighting. All 5 skaters for the Rangers dropped the gloves and fought. And it was this kind of sideshow element to it. I mean, I totally get people that are a little turned off by that sort of thing. But I also can tell you that after the game, just hearing from the players, and then especially what I heard from the players following this practice that I went to today on Thursday, this, I do believe, has a special meaning in the locker room. This is a galvanizing moment for the team. The common feeling, the basic thread that they have in the locker room of wanting to have each other's backs, wanting to be there for each other, especially Rempe because he's been challenged so many times and called out so many times. Trouba said this today, that they just wanted to make sure that he knew that he's not in this alone. So there was, I think, this team bonding element to this as well. But then the fight ends and you see all 10 guys skating to the penalty box. And I have to be honest, I did not really register that this is a rule because I've seen line brawls before and it has not always resulted in all of these ejections, all of these game misconduct penalties. And it was actually explained to me by somebody else that in a situation where the referees cannot determine which two players engaged in a fight first, if everybody seems to simultaneously start fighting, then they usually just assess everybody a 5-minute major and move on. But if the refs feel that they can clearly determine one player, or I should say two players in one fight, start first and then others begin to engage, and I actually did go and find this in the NHL rulebook, it is a thing, that the second, third, fourth, fifth, however many other fights start going on after that first one started, all of those players, according to the rulebook, are supposed to be assessed with game misconduct penalties. So if you go back and you watch the replay, you'll actually see that the first two guys to start fighting, the first guys to actually get their hands on each other, were Jimmy Vesey and Curtis Lazar. So those two guys just get the 5-minute majors and go to the penalty box. Everybody else, including Rempe and McDermott, who obviously it was clear that they were going to fight right from the beginning, so that's where everybody's eyes were. But if you watch, they slowly kind of drop the gloves, circle each other a bit before they actually started engaging. So those guys, along with Trouba, along with Gaudreau, along with Miller, all end up getting game misconduct penalties, which meant both the Devils and the Rangers had to play pretty much the entire game minus the first 2 seconds with 10 forwards and 4 defensemen. So we've had these conversations about resting guys and that sort of thing recently. All that got thrown out the window. Pretty much all the defensemen on both sides had to play close to, if not, I think Luke Hughes for the Devils led all skaters in ice time over 30 minutes, which is a lot to ask of guys at this time of year. And to be honest, in talking to the players, I don't think they realized that they were all going to get thrown out of that game afterwards either. So it was kind of a surprise to everybody, but that's how it went down. And again, according to the rule book, that was the right way to call it. So it ends up just being this freaky, crazy, very unique circumstance. And I mean, it has just taken on a life of its own as far as that story in the last few days, or especially I should say the last 24 hours at the time that I'm recording this. And that turned Thursday into another crazy runaround. I thought Thursday was going to be this relatively chill day where I got to record the podcast. I had the Lafreniere story going up. I was going to probably go to practice and just chat with a few guys, but nothing too crazy, maybe not even right today. Instead, it's just been one thing after another. This is a complete side note on my own, but I decided, all right, this is looking like it's going to be a pretty busy day. I'm going to get up early in the morning because my son is turning 3 on Saturday. My in-laws are coming up to town. We got a party going on Saturday. And I told my wife at some point this week, I'll get to Costco to buy the stuff that we need for the party. So even though I worked very late on Wednesday night between covering the game, doing SNY, writing my story, I didn't probably get in bed until close to 1 a.m. And then I'm up at like 7 a.m. I decide, all right, I'm up early. My wife took my son to daycare because she had to go to New Jersey for work. I'm going to go to Costco and get this stuff taken care of early. I pull into the parking lot and then I find out that Costco does not open until 10 a.m. So that's how my day started. I had to go home and then race back over there at 10 a.m. and then race to Rangers practice with all those groceries in my car. And I, by the way, still have to run and get my son in a little while from daycare, which is another reason this episode is only going to have the 2 segments. But in between those 2 things, I did run to practice. And despite there only being 10 guys skating, because it was an optional practice, and again, a lot of guys logged very heavy minutes on Wednesday night, it was maybe, I'd have to really rack my brain to say this for sure, but in the moment it feels like this, the most entertaining locker room that I have seen in my 5 years on this beat. We talked to all the guys that were involved in the fight, and they all had their own unique stories. Keandre Miller, I got a real kick out of him because I went over to him and was like, hey, I guess you figured it was time to get your first NHL fight. Kind of smiled at that. And he described the fight between him and Marino. And Miller said at first he didn't really have intentions of fighting anybody. You know, talking to the players, Everybody agreed and knew that Rempe was going to fight, but it seemed like a very spontaneous thing that the other guys all decided to engage. And Miller sounds like he didn't really have plans of fighting. And, you know, he's not really the fighting type of guy, although he did mention that he has done some boxing training and things of that nature in the offseason. That way, if it ever does come to that, he feels like he's prepared and ready to go. So that was kind of a cool little side note that he gave us there. But he said he's standing around, as he put it, watching the fireworks. And all of a sudden, he notices Marino skate over to him, make eye contact, and kind of give him a nod. And Miller was like, all right, I guess we're going to do this. And Miller said, in his little quiet, confident kind of way, I thought it was a bad idea. Then I guess he found out, because again, Miller ended up pummeling him. That was certainly, I think, the most decisive victory of any of the fights that went down during that line brawl. And so we talked to Miller, we talked to Truba, we talked to Gaudreau, because we didn't talk to any of them on Wednesday night. So it was really interesting to hear all those perspectives on Thursday. And then in comes Matt Rempe. And I have to tell you guys, we've talked about this before as well, but obviously he's getting a lot of attention for all of the fighting. Obviously, this guy has been, in my opinion, a really genuinely nice kid away from the ice, and has that background story that kind of tugs on the heartstrings as far as his father passing away and making his NHL debut on the anniversary of that. And as much of a tough guy as the perception might be for those who just see him pop up on social media or pop up on highlights because of these fights, it's a really nice, genuine kid behind the scenes. But I will say, he's a good storyteller. He's getting really comfortable in front of the TV, in front of the cameras, in front of the microphones, and he absolutely held court. I mean, he was going through every bit of what happened with us, the lead up, the what it meant to him to have his teammates stand up for him in that way. He talked about them being his brothers, and that he loves them, and that it was a very special thing for him to look around, because he at first was just so fixated on fighting McDermott. He said he knew that that was going to happen. Obviously, that came as no surprise to him. He said one way or another, at some point in that game, because of the fact that he had been called out and because he knew that the Devils took issue with the hit on Siegenthaler, which Rempe, to his credit, has been pretty apologetic about, but he knew that the code, or whatever you want to call it, would require him to fight, and he came into the night prepared to do that. But he said at a certain point, he starts realizing that there's all these other fights going on around him. And I think that that moment of team unity, that meant a lot, I think, to the entire locker room, but it especially meant a lot to Rempe. And you can just hear it in the way that he talked about it. And I wrote a story that has all these quotes from him. I mean, just one juicy quote after another, one good story after another. So definitely check that one out as well. Well, you're hopefully in a bit of a reading mood, but he went through it all. I mean, the way that he described McDermott coming up to him, kind of huffing and puffing right at that opening faceoff and being like, we're doing this now. You're not going to avoid this now. And Rempe's like, yeah, man, obviously they put us out here to start this for a reason. So that was obviously, that was really funny. He was talking about being excited about spending 5 minutes in the penalty box with his teammates. He said we were going to cuddle up and get cozy. And then all of a sudden the referees come over and they're like, no, you guys are all kicked out of the game. And his first thought was, dang it, my time on ice isn't going to go up in this game, because obviously he's only averaging like 5 or 6 minutes a game. And that's getting hurt every time that he gets kicked out of one of these games. He talked about McDermott and how tough of a customer he was, and how much respect he has for him and that fight. And he also talked about Keandre Miller and how excited he was to go and watch the highlights of that. Jacob Trouba said he was just bouncing off the walls, meaning Rempe, once they all got into the locker room and basically had to just watch the rest of the game. And it sounds like he's in there scrolling his phone, probably reading some of your tweets out loud to his teammates, and they were all getting a good laugh out of that. And I mean, this guy was just on cloud nine. As Peter Laviolette said, he is loving life right now. So it's developed into this cool story. Now, again, you want to be a little careful about glorifying fighting and all that, but there's obviously an understanding from Rempe that for him to stick in the NHL, for him to really earn a consistent lineup spot on a team that's as loaded as the Rangers are, that him bringing that toughness, him bringing that willingness to stand up for his teammates and do that sort of thing, that's only going to help his cause. And I'm certainly not going to fault him for that. But I also would say that it's become very clear to me in these conversations with him, and he's repeated this multiple times now, that he really wants to show that he can play beyond just the fighting. He wants to show that he can play the game effectively enough to maybe be a regular in the lineup. And especially, he specifically said today, he wants to prove that he can be a part of this playoff lineup. And that is probably, from a big picture standpoint, the most intriguing part about all of this. Obviously, the fights are going to get a lot of attention. Obviously, you know, he's loving it. He's having a great time right now. But there's also this element of he does not want to be the sideshow. He does not want to be the goon who is only known for fighting. And what Peter Laviolette said today is that in these final six regular season games, I don't think you're going to see Rempe play in all of them, but you are going to see him get some opportunities, because it really does look like it is coming down to whether or not the Rangers are going to use Rempe or Johnny Brodzinski as their 12th forward once the playoffs come around. Now, that very much could be lineup dependent, or matchup dependent, I should say, because there are certain opponents where I think the Rangers might value the speed, the little bit more of a scoring touch that you're going to get from Johnny Brodzinski. But then there are going to be other opponents where I think they might look at Rempe and the size and the physicality and the toughness and just the chaos, as Rempe put it, that he brings on the forecheck, where I think they might value that more. For example, if they play a team like the Philadelphia Flyers, which right now it looks like there's a very real chance of that happening, then I definitely think that that would play more into Rempe's hands. But Laviolette said he's also open to the idea, whether that's in the regular season or whether it becomes clear during the playoffs, of one of those two guys solidifying their spot in the lineup. So Rempe, I don't think, is a shoo-in to be in the lineup right now, but I definitely think that he is in the mix. You know, and depending on how a series goes, if it starts one way and the Rangers have one of those guys in there, but the series isn't going their way and they want to change the momentum, you could also see an in-series change for sure. I think that is a very real possibility. But Rempe was making the point today, after we got through all the laughs and all the fun little tidbits from behind the scenes and who said what to who and what was going on at every different point of that night, he made it very clear. He kind of finished on a little more of a serious note that he wants to show that he can help this team in more ways than just fighting. And that continues to be the message that we're getting from Peter Laviolette as well. So that story has kind of overtaken everything right now. I mean, other than that, the Rangers are mostly cruising right now. They did lose to the Pittsburgh Penguins on Monday night, which is a game where, you know, especially if you were watching for long stretches, or even if you just looked at the stats later, it didn't completely go against the Rangers. The Rangers certainly had opportunities to go ahead and take control of that game, I thought at least. But there were some very glaring mistakes that I think hurt them and the Penguins took advantage of. And Sidney Crosby continues to just defy age and defy logic and just be one of the best players in the world, even to this day, when he's getting ready to turn 37. Although I shouldn't say 37 is very old, because I myself am also getting ready to turn 37. But the Rangers lose that one game, and it did seem to draw a harsher reaction, I think, from a lot of the fans than I would expect at this point in the season, with them having clinched and all that. But they have also won six of their last seven, and they're sitting pretty right now if you look at the standings. 3 points up for the number one overall seed in the Eastern Conference. We've talked about the significance of that, because if you can lock up that number one seed, not only do you get home ice advantage throughout, but you also avoid that potential wild card showdown with the Tampa Bay Lightning, which I think we all agree is the opponent that you would least like to see in the first round. And they're also now 5 points up on the Carolina Hurricanes for first place in the Metro Division. So the Rangers are in a really, really good spot right now, which again makes it a little bit of a head scratcher. I mean, I guess you can understand the natives getting a little bit restless because the playoffs are right around the corner. We can all see it coming. Only 6 games left in the regular season. And I think fans are maybe nitpicking a little bit more, maybe getting a little more nervous about some of the stuff that they feel like could be exposed as a flaw once we get to the playoffs. And the Rangers definitely have some stuff to clean up. The turnovers have crept back into their game at times. I mean, you've seen the Rangers open up their offense. You've seen them getting contributions from beyond just that Panarin, Trocheck, Lafreniere line. Recently, the power play has definitely picked things up recently. Kaapo Kakko is riding a 5-game point streak right now. He scored a key goal in that game against the Devils. And you're also now starting to get some of your defensemen back, but we've seen rust in some of those cases for sure. And we've seen that because the Rangers seem to be opening up the risk factor a little more, that they've had some really bad turnovers that have resulted in goals against recently. So that's been an issue we've talked about. That's obviously something that once the playoffs come around, they need to tighten up and they need to especially limit those odd man rushes against that we know have given them problems when they have gone through their limited tough stretches, really that one tough stretch that they had in the middle of the season. And I guess quickly, I can just spend a minute here on Jacob Trouba because I know that he has drawn by far, it seems, the most ire of the fan base since his return from injury. He's really only played 2 games because he only played 2 seconds again in that Devils game. And listen, the simplest way that I could put it when it comes to Trouba is, are there flaws there? Absolutely. He is not the strongest skater. He is occasionally prone to costly giveaways. We saw that for sure to open up that game against the Penguins the other night. It led directly to a Pittsburgh goal and put the Rangers in a hole that they were never able to dig themselves out of. A very, very glaring mistake. And Trouba, after the game, came out and said that the quote he used is holding the team back since his return. His 2 games back, the one in Arizona and the one against Pittsburgh, have been probably his 2 worst or 2 of his worst performances of the season. Now, 2 games is an incredibly small sample size, so I find the reactions to 2 bad games to be over the top. Again, I think that speaks to everybody just being anxious and a little restless and a little nervous with the playoffs right around the corner. But if I'm being fair, I'll tell you, Trouba, if you're just judging him based on his contract, which I know seems to be a hot topic of conversation with fans, is he worth $8 million in an ideal world? No, he is probably not that level of player. Is he a guy who the Rangers are typically having the ice tilted in their favor when he's on the ice? Not necessarily. I mean, if you look at the analytics for a lot of their defensemen outside of Adam Fox, and I guess you would throw Erik Gustafsson in there because he has pretty good analytics as well, most of them rate out negatively when it comes to expected goal rates, shot share, things of that nature. So Trouba falls into that category. But I also do think that if you look at how many goals the Rangers are allowing while he's on the ice compared to last season, for me, last season was a worse year for him. And I've talked to him about dealing with the pressure of the captaincy and how that might have affected his play last year. And I do believe that there's a little something to that. And I do think that as he gets deeper into this contract, it could be a little more problematic. And you might have to make some hard decisions as far as where he slots in to the lineup. But I also think that if you look at his body of work before the injury, the goals against with him and Miller, a pair that's taken a lot of heat and a lot of points rightfully so over the years, they've done a better job defensively this season than they did last season. That's indisputable. So I think it's a little bit of recency bias going on here. Obviously, fans got really attached to Zach Jones during those 13 games that he played while Trouba was out because he played pretty well. Now, the analytics, again, there don't paint a super great picture. He's like a 43 expected goal rate when he was in the lineup. But, you know, I'm not going to put too much stock in those. You guys know that I don't think that analytics are the be-all, end-all when it comes to judging players. And to me, Jones looked more confident than I've ever seen him at any previous point with the Rangers. So I think that he made some really big strides, some really important steps during this stretch. And I talked to him about this the other day. He's absolutely feeling like his game is in a really good place right now. And I think internally, the Rangers are going to give serious consideration to letting him enter next season as somebody that they're penciling into their lineup. That might mean letting Gustafsson walk in the offseason. But it's just unrealistic to think that Peter Laviolette was ever going to entertain the idea of benching his captain in favor of Jones. Now, Jones, again, to his credit, has played well, but when it comes to the playoffs, when it comes to the physical, tough, grind it out, hard to play against elements that we know not just the Rangers, but most teams around the league value at that time of year, that Trouba brings that in spades. You're going to see him, and we've seen it this year, play games where it's over 20 minutes, blocks five shots, registers six hits, sells out his body on every single play. Now, again, is he going to get beat sometimes? Yes. Is he going to make some costly turnovers at times? Yes. But again, if you look at his giveaway numbers, he's averaging like half a turnover per game. It's not an outrageously high number. I just think that he's had some really glaring ones, and he needs to cut that down. Miller needs to cut that down. There's a few guys on this team that have the tendency to do that. But I think in the eyes of Peter Laviolette, it's kind of laughable to think or suggest that he wouldn't be in the lineup. Now, some fans have argued maybe he should move down to the third pair. We could come to a point where that's a conversation, but I'm just telling you, this isn't even my opinion. This is just what I know and what I sense from the organization and from Laviolette. Nobody internally is talking about that. And you could say that's a mistake if you want, but I think that playoff hockey is a different animal. And I think that when we talk about a guy like Rempe, for example, and what might get him into the lineup, the size, the physicality, the elements that he brings that get under the opponent's skin and make the Rangers feel like a team that's more intimidating, more imposing to play against, Trouba is the guy in the back end who brings more of that than anybody else. So might there come a point where if these struggles continue that we've seen in his first two games back that we have to have a harder conversation about him? Absolutely. But I just feel like there's been this wave of overreaction to just two games. Now, is that saying the rest of his season was perfect? No. Again, that is not what I'm saying here. This is definitely an imperfect player, as pretty much all players are. But there's an argument to be made that you are going to get exposed at time continuously playing him against the opposing team's top lines and things of that nature. But we also know that he's capable of making some of the physical plays. And we know that a lot of fans are going to love it when you see him lay out, I don't know, pick an opponent, whether it's the Capitals and it's Ovechkin, or whether it's the Red Wings and it's Patrick Kane. When he lays out one of those big time players on the opposing team and makes one of those game altering plays, we know that a lot of fans are going to love that as well. So I don't think that some of the criticism is not warranted. I think some of it is, but again, I just feel like it's been a little too focused on just these two games and a little bit of recency bias and a little bit of just having a short memory for a guy that logged a pretty heavy load for the Rangers for most of the season prior to his injury. And while, yes, he is going to likely be on ice for some pretty key goals against, that also comes down to his usage. And Peter Laviolette, for better or for worse, his top pair that he wants out there logging what he calls the heavy minutes is Miller and Trouba. Now, maybe that will alter a little bit, but I also think that because those guys play those difficult situations more than anyone else, you're also going to see them give up more goals than anybody else. It just kind of stands to reason. So I don't know. It's more of a nuanced conversation that we can have in the coming weeks. And I do think there's some slight merit to being a little worried based on what we've seen since he's come back. But I got to see a little bit more before I really start jumping to conclusions here. And for me, I can just tell you what I know. And what I know is the Rangers are definitely not taking him out of the lineup and highly, highly unlikely to drop him to the third pair. All right, with that, I got to run because Neil Smith is about to join me on our Zoom call in just a few minutes. So I hope you guys are going to enjoy that interview. Again, we will not have a final segment. So enjoy listening to this interview with the former Rangers GM, the cup-winning GM of the Rangers in 1994. And then I will be back next week with a brand new podcast to once again continue to get us set for the playoffs. So enjoy the interview with Neil, and I will talk to you guys next week.
Now let's welcome into the show a very special guest, a guest that I know a lot of Rangers fans are going to really enjoy hearing from. He was the general manager of the Rangers from 1989 until the year 2000. That includes, of course, the 1994 Stanley Cup championship winning team, the last in franchise history to win a cup. We are now approaching the 30-year anniversary of that championship. And that, of course, would be Neil Smith, who also, by the way, I should mention, hosts a podcast every week called the NHL Wraparound. So also be sure to check that out if you get a chance. But Neil, thank you first off for joining us. This is really exciting, and it's a special time, I know, for you and everybody who was a part of that 94 team, because this is the 30-year anniversary. So I guess we could start right there and just tell me, I mean, is that kind of wild to wrap your head around? Does it feel like it's been 30 years?
It actually doesn't. It feels like it was yesterday in some ways, and then it also feels like it was 30 years ago. It's very vivid in my mind. I'm very obviously proud of that that year and many other years that we had there. But that's life, right? How did I get here? How am I already this age that I am? How am I already here? How are we 30 years past that already? It's just the way life goes.
It's wild, and I mentioned to you before, I was 7 years old when it happened. It remains my first vivid hockey memory, so that's a pretty cool one that I have in the back of my mind. And now we'll see where the current Rangers are heading, and I definitely want to pick your brain a bit about that. But I want to start with talking to you a bit about the 94 team, and specifically about team building, because that was on my mind as I was thinking about this conversation today. And you guys, prior to 94, had a lot of success, and you touched on it. I know you won the President's Trophy a couple of years before, but it took a certain process that you had to go through to, I guess, figure out exactly what the team needed to get over the hump. And it seems like that's a similar spot where the Rangers are right now. So what can you tell us that you remember about that process, about what it took for you guys to ultimately get there, and maybe even some of the low moments that maybe might have been necessary in order to help you figure out exactly what needed to happen?
Well, I think that the culture had to change with the Rangers that we had in 89 when I got there. And we continued with it, you know, through 89, 90, and 90, 91. And then it became very evident to me that we better accelerate this process to see if we could get to winning, and Mark became available, Messier, and so I had to take it a chance. And when I say take a chance, it may seem silly to some people to say that, but there wasn't a lot of buyers at that time for Mark, because Mark had been through so much hockey in his career, and Glenn Sather was such a horse trader at those days, and people assumed that there was something maybe wrong or that. So, but I felt that we had to get that winning culture into the Rangers. And so certainly bringing Mark in did that in spades. After that, I did get Adam Graves, which is actually, he was acquired before Mark, but because I knew him from Detroit. We did get Jeff Bookaboom right after Mark, which is sort of in the Mark trade. And so there you've got three Stanley Cup winners already. And then as the process went along, I wanted to acquire as many guys that had been to the Cup as possible, because I think my theory is that if you've won it once, you'll really want to win it again. And there's a lot of Stanley Cup champs that repeat. We went after a lot of Oilers and other people that I thought could piece the thing together. Eddie Olchuk was a really good player with the Winnipeg Jets. He came in. Kevin Lowe, of course, was a leader with the Edmonton Oilers and others. But it was a process of piecing together a winning combination. But I can never say enough that Messier made that culture switch happen for us. I couldn't do that from my seat as GM. I could only do that by planting those people into the organization that I thought could help change the player base.
You mentioned some of the trades, and heading into that 1994 trade deadline, you made a series of moves. I'm sure some of them, you know, especially you look at a guy like Doug Weight and what he turned into, I'm sure there were some really difficult decisions for you in there. But by doing that, by acting, it seemed at the time, at least, and especially now in retrospect, pretty bold the way that you were making those moves. What was your, I guess, main goal in that situation? What did you feel that the team needed, and what did you feel like those guys were going to help you accomplish?
Well, Doug Weight was actually traded the season before for Asa Tikkanen. And I was trying to get as many guys that had won the cup as possible. And I thought that Tikkanen, you know, was a guy that everybody would want on their team, but hated him if he was on the other team. So, you know, you want him. And in the 94 season, we needed a little bit more bolstering. Even though we were winning the President's Trophy that year, we needed to be bolstered. And we only traded two active players from the team, Tony Amonte and Mike Gartner. Both Mike Gartner's a Hall of Famer, and Tony Amonte turned into the star that I thought he would. But the thing was that for those two players, active players, we ended up putting four players on the team. So you knew you had to be better if you got McTavish to come in to be that shutdown center and faceoff guy, and he replaced nobody. He was just an addition. If you've got both Noonan and Matto to replace Tony Amonte, well, you got two of them. And then you had Glenn Anderson for Gartner, which was sort of a swap, in meaning that Glenn Anderson had had tremendous playoff success. Mike had had great seasons in the NHL, without a doubt. And so you knew you had to have fortified your team going in. And, you know, you hoped that they would all gel together. Yes, it was bold. I can't see anybody ever being able to do something like that again because of the salary cap and the way that you have to take so many things into consideration. But I knew that I had to swing for the fence at that turn up to bat that year in 93-94, that this was our win and we got to get it done this year, because we should have got it done in 92. Pittsburgh knocked us out and never lost a game after that. And I felt had we got by Pittsburgh and Mario Lemieux, we would have gone on to not lose another game, or we would have won the cup in 1992. And who knows what would have happened in 93 and 94. But it was really important that I did everything I could do to make the team as good as it could be.
It's probably a hard question to answer, but when you look back on those moves, do you feel like the team wouldn't have been able to ultimately win had you not done that? Do you feel like those are all necessary moves that were required? And you know, especially if you look down the line, you know, people wonder, could you guys have won more? Or, you know, do you kind of go back in your mind, I guess, at points and wonder about some of those what ifs?
I've been asked by Mike Gartner fans, of which I'm one, by the way. Mm-hmm. Could you have still won it if you hadn't made that trade of Gartner for Anderson? And of course, it's a fictitious question. Glenn Anderson scored a couple of winning goals in the playoffs for us. He's very close to Messier. Who knows? Would Mike Gartner maybe would have scored more winning goals? He was certainly capable. We'll never know. If could we have kept Tony Amonte and not brought in Matto and Noonan? But then, you know yourself, the goals that Matto and Noonan scored and how important they were to that team. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the day, we won one Stanley Cup in my 11 years. I wish we would have won more. But you know what? I'm so happy that we won one, and I'm so fortunate that I was there and was given the chance to build that team. And so it's a life-changing event.
Yeah, the hypotheticals probably don't do anybody any good, but I can't help myself but kind of wonder about those things sometimes, because I just find it all fascinating. But I also want to ask you about this. I mentioned to you earlier, Rick Carpinello, I finished reading his book actually at the beginning of the season, and there's a lot of really interesting nuggets about that 94 season in there. And, you know, you and Coach Mike Keenan, it sounds like there was definitely some stuff going on behind the scenes there. It sounds like the working relationship, I don't know if you would call it tense, strained, you know, maybe I'll let you decide how you'd want to classify that. But can you tell us a bit about what that was like, knowing that you had this really intense coach who obviously made some really good things happen with the team, but it also sounded like behind the scenes, whether it was player acquisitions and maybe disagreeing on some things there or what have you, that at times it sounds like there were some really tense moments.
There were some tense moments. I mean, I didn't like Mike. I mean, I started out liking him, but I didn't like him when I saw the way that he treated people. And then I didn't like Mike when he, you know, sort of disrespected my position. But having said that, I knew that we needed a guy to coach this team that kept everybody off balance. I didn't need to be kept off balance. I didn't need that, but the players need that. And so Mike was the right coach at the right time, and I had to pay the price, and that's okay, because you know, I just would do anything to win. And, you know, I had to work with him and I had to put up with some of his BS. But that's okay, because we got where we wanted to go.
How important was it to have Messier at that time to sort of function as the leader in the room who, if players at certain points, you know, weren't thrilled with Keenan or whatever might be going on, that Messier was the guy who kind of kept everybody on the same page?
Well, you can't even give a description of his importance to that 94 team and to the 92 team and the 93 team and the 95 team. I mean, just a leader of men and a leader of all the Ranger players that were there, and dealing with Mike Keenan. Yeah, he was very important that, we had someone strong enough to deal with the coach who was, you didn't know what you were going to get from day to day. And maybe that's why the players played so well, because they didn't know what they were going to be facing every day. But Mark had the courage to take him on when he had to be taken on.
Let me ask you now, as we look ahead, do you see many similarities to the point that the Rangers are at right now with this core of players, where they had that good run a couple of years ago, maybe arrived a little bit ahead of schedule, expectations were high for them last year, they met some disappointment similar to the disappointment that you guys maybe met in 92 or even 93, and now they're at a point where they're cruising, looking like they have a very real shot at the President's Trophy themselves, looking like one of the best teams in the league, and now feeling like maybe the Ducks are in a row for them to go on another run this season. I mean, do you see a lot of similarities to where the two teams were at this point, 30 years difference?
I do, in that they have the elements that you need to be successful. A veteran coach who's been there, a superior star goaltender who could win games on his own. In my book, a great leader on defense in Trouba. They've got the Adam Graves type guy in Chris Kreider, although Adam Graves could take care of, you know, take care of the physical of the game. You know, it was a different era, but I do see that in this era, if you get into the top five or six teams, you have a very real shot of winning because of what can happen with the other dominoes. So what we saw last year was the best team I've seen in many years get knocked out in the first round, Boston Bruins. Like, they were easily the best team in the league. Now, does that mean that Florida could win it because it got all the way to the final? I never thought for a moment Florida would win it. I thought that it was amazing what they were doing, but I didn't think they'd win it, because I knew when they got to the final, they were going to face one of the best teams in the West, and they were not one of the best teams in the East. They were just a good playoff team. And now this year, they're a good regular season team, Florida Panthers I'm talking about. And so I think that there's, there is a very real chance that the Rangers could go on an extended run. Their dominance within the league, you can't even compare the points or the wins and losses because we didn't have the three-point games. We didn't have the shootouts and all that stuff. I don't think they're as dominant a team in the NHL as we were back then. We were the Devils were second best to us in the entire league. We had beaten them many times in the regular season. And I think we were more of the odds on favorite going right into the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. than the current Rangers. But the current Rangers could do what the Vegas Knights did last year. You know, they weren't the odds on favor going in, and yet they won the Stanley Cup. Colorado 2 years ago, I thought was going to win the cup before the playoffs started. In fact, I said it on a broadcast. Then one of the hosts asked me, okay, I'm going to put you on the spot. Who's going to win the cup? I guess you don't want to answer that. And I said, no, I'll answer it. It's going to be Colorado. And luckily for me, it was. So anyways, I do see similarities in the way the team is built. And someone said to me, do you think we have a chance this year? This was just the other night. And I said, yeah, you always have a chance when you're in the top teams. You know, you always have a chance. Why don't you have as good a chance as anybody?
It does feel like if you look at the top teams in the NHL, there is no odds on favorite. There's a handful that you feel like if they get hot at the right time could get it done. But it feels like, especially look at the Eastern Conference right now, whether you talk about Rangers, Bruins, Hurricanes, the Panthers right now, you know, I think any of those teams, once they get in there, feel like they have a shot to go on a run. So that kind of makes it a little more interesting in some respects. I wonder when you look at the Rangers sort of putting on your GM hat for a moment, they did seem to address their needs. I mean, we knew they needed a center. We knew they needed a right winger who potentially could play on the top line with Zibanejad and Kreider at the deadline. They had some defenseman depth. I mean, do you feel like what they did was enough, or going back to what we talked about earlier with the bold moves that you made, do you feel like maybe they needed to aim a little higher and be a little more bold?
I don't know what the possibilities were for Drury. So I think though that in the acquisitions he made from Seattle and from Columbus respectively, I think he added depth to his team. And depth is really important heading into the playoffs, quality depth. I didn't like what he did last year when he did it. I'm not criticizing anybody, but I didn't think that would work. I didn't think getting Tarasenko and Kane was the right thing to do at that late stage in the season. I think what he did at the deadline was the right thing to do. Leave the leadership as it is, leave the top guys where they are, bring in a couple of supplementary players. And what else was available? I don't really know. You know, if he'd blown the bank to get Gensel, for example, it would have been very interesting. Obviously, Gensel's a great player. From what I hear, he's a great person. But would that have upset the apple cart again, the way that the Kane and Tarasenko thing sort of upset the apple cart? Who knows? And again, I got to say, I don't know what Chris had available to him at the deadline.
It is interesting, I think, to maybe consider the lessons learned from last year, where it felt like they got a little caught stargazing and went for some of those big names. And now this year they were able to fill needs. And if you look at it from a value standpoint, they didn't really have to give up anything of huge significance. They held on to their first round pick. They held on to all their top prospects. So I guess, you know, from a GM perspective there, you could look at it and say, well, they got pretty good value. They filled their needs and they didn't have to empty the cupboard to do it.
No, and that is paramount because, you know, you as a general manager, you're supposed to keep one eye on the present and one eye on the future, and you're responsible for both. Okay. And I got to tell you, like, I hated Tony Amandi trade. I've said this a gazillion times. I hated it. I'm a scout by my background, and I love Tony Amandi as a player. I thought he was going to be a star. I didn't want to trade him for two third line players, but that was necessary to get us where we needed to go right then at that moment. Our window was open. And you got to be very careful as a manager when you decide that window is there. Is it really there? Or are you seeing, a mirage? And there's, no matter what the press and the fans say, you can't get sucked into that. You got to make your own decision of whether it's there or it's not there and what the right thing to do is. Because remember that even if you get support of ownership or media, if you don't win, those people all forget that they supported your decision, but you can never be forgotten because you were the one that actually did it. So, it's all on you. You know, no matter how many people would have drafted some of the players that I drafted, where I drafted them, when they don't turn out, it's my mistakes. So it's not their mistake, even though they said, yeah, you should take that guy. So anyway, it's a tough job, and I think that he did a good job at the deadline.
Neil, there's so many other things I'd like to ask you about. We could probably reminisce or tell stories or go into all the different kinds of paths with this interview, but I know you've got places to be. I mentioned to you before, I got to run and get my son from daycare soon, so I'm going to have to let you go here, but I really, really appreciate the time. This has been a great conversation. Maybe we'll do it again another time down the line and we can go into some different topics. And everybody, again, make sure to check him out with his podcast, the NHL Wraparound. So, Neil, thank you so much. Really do appreciate it. And congratulations to you on 30 years, because I think with each passing year, everybody has a little bit more appreciation for A, the accomplishment itself, and B, how difficult it is to get there. And we'll see if and when the Rangers can finally add another banner up there in Madison Square Garden.
Well, I hope I'm still available to you to come on when it's 50 years.
Yes, me too. Me too.
I can't wait to see your son in 20 years and see him in, he'll have graduated college. So there you go.
Thanks a lot, Neil. I do appreciate it.
Okay. No problem, Vince. See you later.